You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. I'm Catherine Hastings. Well, it's December, and I've decided to take a brief departure from poetry, at least for a little while tonight, and air two short stories, one actually a novel. You are, I'm sure, familiar with the 1933 novel Lost Horizon by James Hilton. In 1941, there was a radio play adapted from the novel starring Ronald Colman and Donald Crisp. I'm going to start tonight's program by airing Lost Horizon. Following that, we will hear the ever so traditional A Child's Christmas in Wales, read by Dylan Thomas. But first, sit back, put up your feet, and here is Lost Horizon.
You are deep in the mountains of Tibet, the highest part of the Earth's surface. That snow-capped peak above you is Karakal. And below, in the Valley of the Blue Moon, lies the Lamasery of Shangri-La.
Our guide was a man whom we knew only as Chang. Reaching the heights above the valley, he pointed far into the distance.
Shangri-La.
It was a strange and incredible sight. A group of colored pavilions clinging to the mountainside, like flower petals impaled upon a crag. The eye was carried upward from the milk-blue roofs to the gray rock looming tremendously overhead, a dazzling pyramid of snow. Beautiful, terrifying. From the stormy cliffs on which we stood to the serene peace and quiet of Shangri-La, was like a descent into another world. I came to this world across the mountains from India. We had been flying from Baskul to Peshawar on the northwest frontier. I was the British consul in Baskul, and my vice consul, a young fellow named Mallinson, was making the trip with me. Besides us, there were two other passengers and the pilot. Our plane should have landed in Peshawar at about 5:30. We never arrived at our destination.
Conway? I say, Conway, are you asleep?
What's that? Oh, what's the matter, Mallinson? Anything wrong?
I'm not sure, but I think our pilot's off his course.
Off his course? Nonsense.
Well, look down there. Nothing but mountains as far as you can see.
I don't recognize this part of the world at all. Yes, I should say you were right, Mallinson. The man's lost his way.
What's that, Conway? Did you say we were lost?
Lost? Oh, good heavens.
Oh, no. It's quite all right, Miss Brinklow. There's nothing to be upset about, I'm sure.
Still, there's nothing like finding out, is there? Shall I speak to the pilot, Conway?
Oh, no, don't bother. I'll do it myself. You there, pilot. Open the panel. Open up. I want to speak to you.
I advise that you ask no questions, please.
Oh, certainly.
Look here, we want to know where we are.
I advise that you be seated.
I will not be seated. I want to find...
Mallinson, I don't know whether you've noticed it, but there's a revolver pointed directly at my chest. Under the circumstances, I think you'd better do as the gentleman suggests. For hours after that, we sat in the darkness of the plane, each of us pretending to sleep. Suddenly, the plane lurched sharply. There was a loud rushing sound in my ears, and I realized that we were coming down. But fast. Much too fast. We stumbled from the plane, badly shaken but uninjured. The cold was intense, a solid icy cold that you could touch with your fingertips. I knew we must be somewhere in Tibet, a vast barren region of wind-swept upland.
Conway, come here. There's something the matter with this pilot fellow, and I can't get a word out of him.
Well, loosen the strap of his helmet. He's still breathing anyhow. Light a match, will you, Barnard?
Here we are.
Now keep lighting them. His pulse is pretty weak. I can hardly feel it. Another match. Mallinson, what's the matter with you?
I can't help it. We look like such a lot of fools, striking matches over a corpse.
There was little we could do for him. We watched his breathing grow more labored every hour. And as the early rays of the sun caught the summit of the mountain, the man died.
I say, Conway.
Yes?
I've just been looking at that mountain. Am I seeing things? Or are those men coming towards us?
They were men. A party of a dozen or more, crawling like ants across the white face of the cliff. As they drew near, we saw they carried among them a hooded chair, and in it, a heavily robed figure, an elderly Chinese, gray-haired, clean-shaven.
Nishihala. I am from the Lamasery of Shangri-La. My name is Chang. You, sir, would you be good enough to present me to your friends?
Oh, yes, of course. This is Miss Brinklow, Mr. Barnard, and Mr. Mallinson. My name is Conway.
Conway, yes. Your ship is beyond repair.
I'm afraid so. And anyway, our pilot is dead.
So, you will come to Shangri-La. I shall be happy to accompany you.
Oh, but you must just have set out from there.
It is a hazardous journey and the only place of habitation within 1,000 miles... I insist upon acting as your guide.
Very well. Thank you.
Our stay won't be long. We'll pay for anything we have, and we'd like to hire some of your porters to help us on the journey back. We want to return to civilization as soon as possible.
Are you so certain you are away from it?
There was a pass at 20,000 feet, which we managed with the aid of long ropes. When we had struggled breathlessly to the top, I saw above us, shimmering in the rosy twilight, the loveliest mountain on earth.
That snow-capped peak above you is Caracal. And below, in the Valley of the Blue Moon, lies the Lamasery of Shangri-La.
I never exactly remembered how we arrived at the Lamasery. The thin air had a dream-like texture, and I was conscious of a strange sensation, half mystical, half visual, of having reached at last some place that was an end, a finality. Shangri-La, I learned, was a sort of monastery whose inhabitants ruled the natives in the valley below. Those in full lamahood numbered about 50, and their prevalent belief was in moderation, the virtue of avoiding excess of all kinds. These things I learned the first night as I stood with Chang on the broad balcony overlooking the valley.
There is something more you would like to know, Mr. Conway?
Please. I want to know, this morning when you found us, were you setting out on a journey?
No.
Then you came there deliberately to intercept us. That suggests that you must have known we were coming. The interesting question is, how?
You are very clever, but not entirely correct. Therefore, I should counsel you not to worry your friends with these abstract discussions.
Oh, they want something more concrete. They want to know exactly how long you're going to keep us here.
There will be certain unavoidable delays.
How long?
The difficulties of the trip, securing the necessary porters.
Oh, how long? Please.
You may tell your friends a few months.
But you don't guarantee it, huh? Is that what you mean? For myself, I can't say I shall mind a great deal. It's a new and interesting experience.
In time to come, you may find it even more interesting. Good night.
In the days that followed at Shangri-La, I gave myself over to a rich and growing enchantment. In the petal-colored buildings which dotted the mountain, I recognized treasures of art that museums and millionaires would have bargained for. Paintings and sketches, exquisite ceramics, preserved for more than 1,000 years. In the spacious library, I discovered the great literature of the present and of centuries past, and all the scientific knowledge of the world. One morning I stood beside a lotus pool in an open pavilion of the lamasery. In an archway behind me, a young girl was seated at a harpsichord, a girl in Chinese dress. Her jet-black hair was drawn tightly back and braided. Her mouth was small and pink. She was like a delicately painted miniature. That was very lovely.
You are pleased?
More than pleased. My name is Hugh Conway.
They call me Lo Tsen.
Lo Tsen. And do you live below in the valley?
No. I live here.
At the lamasery?
Yes. But as yet, I have not attained the full lamahood.
You mean you are a lama?
Yes.
I'm a bit confused. I thought only men could be lamas.
They will tell you, when you have been here longer, that in the lamahood there are no distinctions between a man and a woman.
Oh, but you're hardly more than a child.
Shall I play for you again?
Please.
Good morning.
Oh, well, Chang.
You are pleased with Lo Tsen?
She plays beautifully.
One of our greatest students of music. She has studied for many, many years.
Well, how could she? How old is Lo Tsen?
I'm afraid I cannot tell you.
One night the moonlight fell on Shangri-La, shimmering down from the snow-capped peaks, bathing the pavilion in a sea of blue.
I am sorry to disturb you at this hour, but I bring you important news.
Yes, Chang?
I congratulate you, sir. Tonight you are to be received by the High Lama.
As I followed Chang through the lamasery, I knew I was on the threshold of some great discovery. Pattering in front of me, he mounted a spiral staircase to a door which opened noiselessly before us. Chang left silently. As I became accustomed to the gloom, I saw sitting before me a small and wrinkled man. He was motionless, a fading antique portrait in Chinese dress, his face thin and drawn tight over the frame of his skull, and his eyes, I felt dizzy beneath the gaze of those ancient eyes.
You are Mr. Conway.
I am.
It is a pleasure to see you, Mr. Conway. Please sit down beside me and have no fear. I am an old man and can do no one any harm.
I feel it a great honor to be received by you.
Thank you. Chang tells me you have been asking many questions about our community and its affairs.
I am very much interested in them.
Then if you can spare me a little time, I shall be pleased to give you a brief account of our foundation.
There's nothing I would rather hear.
The history of Shangri-La begins rightly in the city of Pekin in the year 1719. For it was then that four friars set out on a long and perilous journey into the hinterland. They traveled many months by Lan Chao and Koko Nor, facing many hardships. Three died on the way, and the fourth was not far from death when he stumbled into the rocky defile that remains today the only approach to our Valley of the Blue Moon. There, to his joy and surprise, he found a friendly population who bade him welcome. Quickly, he recovered his health and began to preach his mission. His name was Father Perrault. For more than half a century, Father Perrault labored with his hands like any other man, tilling his own garden and learning from the inhabitants as well as teaching them. Then in the year 1789, news descended to the valley that Father Perrault was dying at last. He gathered his friends and servants round him and bade them all farewell. But the end was not yet. He lay for many weeks without speech or movement, and then he began to recover. He was then 108.
The ancient lama paused, his eyes closed as if the discourse had tired him. What he had told me was not beyond belief, but as he went on, I was held speechless with wonder. It was 14 years later, he told me, that a wanderer found his way to Father Perrault's monastery, an Austrian named Henschel. A great friendship sprang up between the two, and Henschel stayed on. It was then that they had a wild, fantastic dream. Art treasures from Europe and Asia were purchased with the valley's gold and stored at Shangri-La. The library was filled with all the great works of the world. And later, it was decided to admit travelers and strangers who had lost their way.
Strangers might come as freely as they wished, but with one important proviso.
And what was that?
In the years that followed, strangers did come. Meanwhile, the lamasery had begun to acquire many of its present characteristics. In 1910, it was almost completed when Henschel died.
Henschel? But what of Father Perrault?
Henschel's death was very sudden. He was killed.
In 1910? But you said he came here in 1803.
Yes.
And he was killed, you said?
Yes. A traveler shot him.
What was the cause of it?
There had been a quarrel about some porters. Henschel had just told him of the important proviso that governs our reception of guests. Perhaps you are wondering, my dear Conway, what that proviso may be.
I think I can already guess. We are to stay here all of our lives.
And can you guess anything else? After this long and curious story of mine?
It seems impossible. And yet, impossible as it may be, I know that it's the truth.
What is, my son?
That you are still alive, Father Perrault. I learned the secret of Shangri-La that night, the secret of prolonged human life. For the High Lama who sat beside me had lived for nearly 2.5 centuries. Our coming was no accident, he said. There had been no travelers to Shangri-La for 20 years. Many lamas had died, and our pilot had been sent out into the world to bring new life to the lamasery. Then there is death at Shangri-La.
Yes, my son. There are many of us who live no more than 100 years.
And those who do live more, when do they begin to grow old in appearance?
Cases differ. Some retain their youth for a century or more. But they must never leave the Valley of the Blue Moon.
And if one of your lamas were to leave the valley?
He would die. His years would fall on his shoulders like a great burden. And he would die very soon, an old, old man.
Lotsen.
You have seen the High Lama.
Lotsen, you must help me. When I spoke with him, I understood everything, and now... Lotsen, how did you come here? How long ago?
I was betrothed to a prince of Turkestan. We were traveling to Kashgar to meet him when my carriers lost their way in the mountains.
When did this happen?
In 1864. I was 18.
18. Then now you are...
The missionaries of Shangri-La found us. They brought us here.
It must have been very difficult for you, your wedding journey.
I had never seen the man I was to marry. It was the custom of our land.
Then, in all these years, you have never known the meaning of love? Lord Zen, is there no love at Shangri-La? Is there no room for love at Shangri-La? Lord Zen? She didn't answer, but I saw a faint flush rising in her ivory cheek. And then I was aware that someone had entered the pavilion and was watching us. It was Mallinson. One night I heard the valley people chanting far below. And at midnight I was summoned to the presence of the High Lama.
Tell me, my son, have you been happy at Shangri-La?
Quite happy, Father Perro. I think I'll always be.
And what of your friends? Will they learn to be content also?
I'm sure that two of them will. I'm afraid Mallinson is going to be a problem.
He is going to be your problem.
Why mine?
Because, my son, I am going to die.
You, Father Perro.
Yes, we are all mortal, even here in the Valley of the Blue Moon. But I must feel at rest before I die. That is why I sent for you tonight.
You do me a great honor, Father.
I have waited for you, my son, for a long time. My colleagues have grown old and wise, but you, who are still young in years, are as wise already. My son, there is a great storm gathering in the world, a black fury which will not spend itself for many years. It may rage till every flower of culture is trampled and all human things are leveled in vast chaos. But I believe that you will live through the storm. Beyond that, my vision weakens. But I see, at a great distance, a new world stirring in the ruins, seeking its lost and legendary treasures. And they will all be here, my son, hidden behind the mountains in the Valley of the Blue Moon. And you will be here to give them to the hopeful world. My son, I place in your hands the heritage and destiny of Shangri-La.
The High Lama stopped speaking. The glow in his eyes faded. Presently, it came to me as in a dream. The High Lama was dead.
Conway, I've been waiting for you. I say, what's the matter, Conway? Are you ill?
No, just tired.
Well, pull yourself together, man. The porters are waiting for us.
Porters?
Yes, it's all arranged. They're going to take us back to Peshawar. Miss Brinkley and Barnard are staying, so
who,
we can...
Who's been making all these plans?
Lotsen. She's with the porters now. She's waiting.
No.
I'm in love with Lotsen, and she loves me. She's coming with us.
Lotsen must not go. It's impossible.
Why? Why is it impossible?
You must take my word for it. Lotsen must never leave here.
Conway, we need your help. We can't manage the cliff without you. I want to get away from this place. And Lotsen, too. She's young. Doesn't she count?
Lotsen is not young.
Not young? You're raving, man.
It's the truth. Her beauty is a fragile thing that can only live where fragile things are loved. Take her away from this valley and she will fade away like an echo. Mallinson, listen to me. I tried then to tell him the secret of Shangri-La. He looked at me as though I were mad. And as I read the disbelief in his eyes, I began to doubt myself. It was too incredible even for me to believe. And then Lotsen came to me.
You will help us, please. We need you.
Lotsen, do you wish to leave Shangri-La?
Yes.
You know? You understand the risk.
I love him. If he is not with me, I would die here.
For hours I paced the balcony. I could not tell whether I had been mad and was now sane, or had been sane for a time and was now mad again. But always before me were the wistful, pleading eyes of a little Manchu girl. And I knew that whatever was her fate, I must share in it. That morning, with the wind roaring through the jagged cliffs, we made the descent from Shangri-La. For weeks, we traveled toward the east, Mallinson, the girl, and I. And then our porters began to desert. One by one, they disappeared, until there were just the three of us, creeping like snails across a desert wilderness. Then, for a long while, we were only two. Mallinson had died. First, I tried to believe it was the hardship of our journey which had changed Lodzen.
I am tired. I can go no further.
We must go on, Lodzen.
I am tired.
There. That must be the last range. That mountain. You see, Lodzen?
It is too far. I cannot see so far.
One more step, Lodzen. One more step. One more. One more.
No. You must go on alone from here.
Her eyes were depthless shadows, her skin drawn, the color of ancient parchment, her cheekbones. Lodzen! Lodzen!
I am old. I am so old.
They found us on the road to Chungkiang, and we were taken to the hospital there. Lodzen, they told me later, Lodzen died that same night. The oldest woman they had ever seen. The storm of which Father Perrault warned me still rages. Not yet has the Christian ethic been fulfilled, when the meek shall inherit the earth. But Shangri-La has a heritage to cherish and bequeath with such wisdom as men will need when their passions are spent. Soon, I hope, I will return. Somewhere beyond Lhasa, on the high roof of the world, I seem to picture a long plateau running north. And far away a mountain, rising white against the sky. I hope to find it again, for this, I think, is Karakal, and beyond is Shangri-La, and the Valley of the Blue Moon.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard a 1941 radio play of Lost Horizon, based on the novel by James Hilton. The radio play featured Ronald Colman and Donald Crisp. If you've seen the movie Lost Horizon, you probably noticed some differences between that movie and the radio play. Lost Horizon as a movie was made in 1937, and it was directed by Frank Capra. The screenplay was by Robert Riskin, and you can probably still rent it if you want to check it out. Okay, we're going to move on now to A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas, and here is the man himself reading it.
One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the Seatown corner now, out of all sound except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep. that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and six nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases rolled down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find. In goes my hand into that wool-white, bell-tongued ball of holidays resting at the rim of the carol-singing sea, and out come Mrs. Prothero and the firemen. It was on the afternoon of the day of Christmas Eve, and I was in Mrs. Prothero's garden waiting for Cat with her son, Jim. It was snowing. It was always snowing at Christmas. December, in my memory, as white as Lapland, although there were no reindeers. But there were cats. Patient, cold, and callous, our hands wrapped in socks, we waited to snowball the cats. Sleek and long as jaguars and horrible whiskered, spitting and snarling, they would slide and sidle over the white back garden walls, and the lynx-eyed hunters, Jim and I, fur-capped and moccasined trappers from Hudson Bay off Mumbles Road, would hurl our deadly snowballs at the green of their eyes. The wise cats never appeared. We were so still, Eskimo-footed Arctic marksmen in the muffling silence of the eternal snows, eternal ever since Wednesday, that we never heard Mrs. Prothero's first cry from her igloo at the bottom of the garden. Or if we heard it at all, it was to us like the far-off challenge of our enemy and prey, the neighbor's polar cat. But soon the voice grew louder. "Fire!" cried Mrs. Prothero, and she beat the dinner gong. And we ran down the garden with the snowballs in our arms towards the house, and smoke indeed was pouring out of the dining room, and the gong was bombolating, and Mrs. Prothero was announcing ruin like a town crier in Pompeii. This was better than all the cats in Wales standing on the wall in a row. We bounded into the house laden with snowballs and stopped at the open door of the smoke-filled room. Something was burning, all right. Perhaps it was Mr. Prothero, who always slept there after midday dinner with a newspaper over his face. But he was standing in the middle of the room saying, "A fine Christmas," and smacking at the smoke with a slipper. "Call the fire brigade," cried Mrs. Prothero as she beat the gong. "They won't be here," said Mr. Prothero. "It's Christmas." There was no fire to be seen, only clouds of smoke, and Mr. Prothero standing in the middle of them waving his slipper as though he were conducting. "Do something," he said. And we threw all our snowballs into the smoke. I think we missed Mr. Prothero and ran out of the house to the telephone box. "Let's call the police as well," Jim said, "and the ambulance. And Ernie Jenkins, he likes fires." But we only called the fire brigade. And soon the fire engine came and three tall men in helmets brought a hose into the house, and Mr. Prothero got out just in time before they turned it on. Nobody could have had a noisier Christmas Eve. And when the firemen turned off the hose and were standing in the wet, smoky room, Jim's aunt, Miss Prothero, came downstairs and peered in at them. Jim and I waited very quietly to hear what she would say to them. She said the right thing, always. She looked at the three tall firemen in their shining helmets standing among the smoke and cinders and dissolving snowballs, and she said, "Would you like anything to read?" Years and years ago, when I was a boy, when there were wolves in Wales and birds the color of red flannel petticoats whisked past the harp-shaped hills, when we sang and wallowed all night and day in caves that smelt like Sunday afternoons in damp front farmhouse parlors, and we chased with the jawbones of deacons the English and the bears. Before the motor car, before the wheel, before the Duchess-faced horse, when we rode the daft and happy hills bareback, it snowed and it snowed. But here a small boy says, "It snowed last year, too. I made a snowman and my brother knocked it down, and I knocked my brother down, and then we had tea." But that was not the same snow, I say. Our snow was not only shaken from whitewashed buckets down the sky. It came shawling out of the ground and swam and drifted out of the arms and hands and bodies of the trees. Snow grew overnight on the roofs of the houses like a pure and grandfather moss. Minutely ivied the walls and settled on the postman opening the gate like a dumb, numb thunderstorm of white, torn Christmas cards. Were there postmen then, too? With sprinkling eyes and wind-cherried noses on spread, frozen feet, they crunched up to the doors and mittened on them manfully. But all that the children could hear was a ringing of bells. You mean that the postman went rat-a-tat-tat and the doors rang? I mean that the bells that the children could hear were inside them. I only hear thunder sometimes, never bells. There were church bells, too. Inside them? No, in the bat-black, snow-white belfries tugged by bishops and storks. And they rang their tidings over the bandaged town, over the frozen foam of the powder and ice cream hills, over the crackling sea. It seemed that all the churches boomed for joy under my window, and the weathercocks crew for Christmas on our fence. Get back to the postman. They were just ordinary postmen, fond of walking and dogs and Christmas and the snow. They knocked on the doors with blue knuckles. Ours has got a black knocker. And then they stood on the white welcome mat in the little drifted porches and huffed and puffed, making ghosts with their breath, and jogged from foot to foot like small boys wanting to go out. And then the presents, and then the presents after the Christmas box. And the cold postman with a rose on his button nose tingled down the tea-tray slithered run of the chilly, glinting hill. He went in his ice-boned boots like a man on fishmonger's slabs. He wagged his bag like a frozen camel's hump, dizzily turned the corner on one foot, and by God, he was gone. Get back to the presents. There were the useful presents, engulfing mufflers of the old coach days and mittens made for giant sloths. Zebra scarves of a substance like silky gum that could be tug-of-war down to the galoshes. Blinding tam-o'-shanters like patchwork tea cozies and bunny-suited busbies and balaclavas for victims of head-shrinking tripes. From aunts who always wore wool next to the skin, there were moustached and rasping vests that made you wonder why the aunts had any skin left at all. And once I had a little crocheted nosebag from an aunt now, alas, no longer whinnying with us. And pictureless books in which small boys, though warned with quotations not to, would skate on Farmer Giles's pond and did and drowned. And books that told me everything about the wasp, except why. Go on to the useless presents. Bags of moist and many-colored jelly babies, and a folded flag and a false nose and a tram conductor's cap and a machine that punched tickets and rang a bell. Never a catapult. Once, by a mistake that no one could explain, a little hatchet. And a celluloid duck that made, when you pressed it, a most unduck-like sound. A mewing moo that an ambitious cat might make who wished to be a cow. And a painting book in which I could make the grass, the trees, the sea, and the animals any color I pleased. And still the dazzling sky-blue sheep are grazing in the red field under the rainbow with billed and pea-green birds. Hard-boiled toffee, fudge and all sorts, crunches, cracknel, humbugs, glaciers, marzipan, and butter Welsh for the Welsh. And troops of bright tin soldiers who, if they could not fight, could always run. And snakes and families and happy ladders and easy hobby games for little engineers, complete with instructions. Oh, easy for Leonardo. And a whistle to make the dogs bark, to wake up the old man next door, to make him beat on the wall with his stick, to shake our picture off the wall. And a packet of cigarettes. You put one in your mouth and you stood at the corner of the street and you waited for hours in vain for an old lady to scold you for smoking a cigarette, and then with a smirk
you ate it. And then it was breakfast under the balloons. Were there uncles like in our house? There are always uncles at Christmas, the same uncles. And on Christmas mornings, with dog-disturbing whistle and sugar fags, I would scour the swathed town for the news of the little world and find always a dead bird by the post office or the white, deserted swings. Perhaps a robin, all but one of his fires out. Men and women wading, scooping back from chapel with taproom noses and wind-busked cheeks, all albinos, huddled their stiff black jarring feathers against the irreligious snow. Mistletoe hung from the gas brackets in all the front parlors. There was sherry and walnuts and bottled beer and crackers by the dessert spoons. And cats in their furabouts watched the fires, and the high-heaped fires spat, all ready for the chestnuts and the mulling pokers. Some few large men sat in the front parlors without their collars, uncles almost certainly, trying their new cigars, holding them out judiciously at arm's length, returning them to their mouths, coughing, then holding them out again as though waiting for the explosion. And some few small aunts, not wanted in the kitchen, nor anywhere else for that matter, sat on the very edges of their chairs, poised and brittle, afraid to break like faded cups and saucers. Not many those mornings trod the piling streets. An old man, always fawn-bowlered, yellow-gloved, and at this time of year with spats of snow, would take his constitutional to the white bowling green and back as he would take it wet or fire or on Christmas Day or Doomsday. Sometimes two hale young men with big pipes blazing, no overcoats and wind-blown scarves, would trudge unspeaking down to the forlorn sea to work up an appetite to blow away the fumes, who knows, to walk into the waves until nothing of them was left but the two curling smoke clouds of their inextinguishable briars. Then I would be slap-dashing home, the gravy smell of the dinners of others, the bird smell, the brandy, the pudding and mince coiling up to my nostrils, when out of a snow-clogged side lane would come a boy, the spit of myself, with a pink-tipped cigarette and the violet past of a black eye, cocky as a bullfinch, leering all to himself. I hated him on sight and sound, and would be about to put my dog whistle to my lips and blow him off the face of Christmas, when suddenly he, with a violet wink, put his whistle to his lips and blew so stridently, so high, so exquisitely loud, that gobbling faces, their cheek bulged with goose, would press against their tinseled windows the whole length of the white echoing street. For dinner we had turkey and blazing pudding, and after dinner the uncles sat in front of the fire, loosened all buttons, put their large, moist hands over their watch chains, groaned a little, and slept. Mothers, aunts, and sisters scuttled to and fro bearing tureens. Aunt Bessie, who had already been frightened twice by a clockwork mouse, whimpered at the sideboard and had some elderberry wine. The dog was sick. Auntie Dursey had to have three aspirins, but Auntie Hannah, who liked port, stood in the middle of the snowbound backyard, singing like a big-bosomed thrush. I would blow up balloons to see how big they would blow up to, and then when they burst, which they all did, the uncles jumped and rumbled. In the rich and heavy afternoon, the uncles breathing like dolphins and the snow descending, I would sit among festoons and Chinese lanterns and nibble dates and try to make a model man-of-war, following the instructions for little engineers, and produce what might be mistaken for a sea-going tramcar. Or I would go out, my bright new boots squeaking into the white world onto the seaward hill, to call on Jim and Dan and Jack, and to pad through the still streets, leaving huge, deep footprints on the hidden pavements. I bet people will think they've been hippos. What did you do if you saw a hippo coming down our street? I'd go like this, bang! I'd throw him over the railings and roll him down the hill, and then I'd tickle him under the ear and he'd wag his tail. What would you do if you saw two hippos?
Iron-flanked and bellowing he-hippos clanked and battered through the scudding snow towards us as we passed Mr. Daniel's house. Let's post Mr. Daniel a snowball through his letterbox. Let's write things in the snow. Let's write, Mr. Daniel looks like a spaniel all over his lawn. Or we walked on the white shore. Can the fishes see it snowing? The silent, one-clouded heavens drifted onto the sea. Now we were snow-blind travelers lost on the North Hills, and vast, dew-lapped dogs with flasks around their necks ambled and shambled up to us, baying excelsior. We returned home through the poor streets, where only a few children fumbled with bare red fingers in the wheel-rutted snow and cat-called after us, their voices fading away as we trudged uphill into the cries of the dock birds and the hooting of ships out in the whirling bay. And then at tea, the recovered uncles would be jolly, and the ice cake loomed in the center of the table like a marble grave. Auntie Hannah laced her tea with rum, because it was only once a year. Bring out the tall tales now that we told by the fire as the gaslight bubbled like a diver. Ghosts wooed like owls in the long nights when I dared not look over my shoulder. Animals lurked in the cubbyhole under the stairs where the gas meter ticked. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house. And we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give them? Hark the herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas. I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas last looked out on the feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under the hot water bottle, gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. Perhaps it was a ghost, Jim said. Perhaps it was trolls, Dan said, who was always reading. Let's go in and see if there's any jelly left, Jack said. And we did that. Always on Christmas night, there was music. An uncle played the fiddle, a cousin sang Cherry Ripe, and another uncle sang Drake's Drum. It was very warm in the little house. Auntie Hannah, who had got onto the parsnip wine, sang a song about bleeding hearts and death, and then another in which she said her heart was like a bird's nest. And then everybody laughed again, and then I went to bed. Looking through my bedroom window, out into the moonlight and the unending smoke-colored snow, I could see the lights in the windows of all the other houses on our hill, and hear the music rising from them up the long, steadily falling night. I turned the gas down. I got into bed. I said some words to the close and holy darkness. And then I slept.
All right. As you know, that was Dylan Thomas reading A Child's Christmas in Wales. Now, I can't close the evening out without a little poetry. I'm going to play two cuts from the CD Word by the Jessica Jones Quartet featuring Candace Jones, who will be on the first cut, Everything Is. And then the second cut, Saratoga Avenue, is written and performed by the poet Arisa White, who will be coming to perform for the Word Temple Poetry Series in 2013. So here is Everything Is and Saratoga Avenue.
names can sometimes mean a lot, especially when they're little things I haven't got. The sound of your breathing right next to my ear, the thrill of a moment that seemed like a year. But a bloom in a garden that's never been tended, crushed before blossoming, cannot be mended. What never was enough is now woefully gone. I feel my heart is aching, but life must go
You smell like Saratoga Avenue. Morning comes with no police sirens. The sun escapes entanglement from the how do I begin tragedies of project buildings. The sunlight cuts the curtains, a machete through bone. We lay like sky and water. Your sleeping face betrayed by a smile uncovers the moon in your teeth. I fall back to sleep, dreaming hurricane kisses, monsoon tongue. You smell like Saratoga Avenue when the night wipes away the afternoon sweat with a rag. A breeze like rubbing alcohol comes quick and cool. The train only makes your body tremble. Love feels like chewing on rocks. Quiet doesn't stay, and you can't hear the heart's rhythms before your left nipple sucks it up. You smell like Saratoga Avenue when Heineken kisses make you dance on invisible waves, and crack severs the chords of your adagio breathing. In a syringe, the symphony concludes. The virus slits you into vertigo. Like rain clouds, the concrete looks for the sun you wait at the corner. You smell like Saratoga Avenue when words wet with old English converge at the corner. Brothers weave worries into hip-hop. He steps out the streetlight with the light skin and wavy hair your mama likes. Persuasively spins his game around you to custom fit like the leather jacket you always wanted. You ride his hip, a 45. He aims, fires, and creates wounds. Plunders the openings and leaves you a bullet-pierced sky, barely breathing in your project box. You smell like Saratoga Avenue's beaten sidewalks. When dreams are forsaken and prayer stains your hands, where women find wings from bedsheets, envisions freedom with the eyes of suicide. Men bleed like unfertilized eggs while the moon completes its own cycle. Wailing walls are called till death, and there's no time to write letters to God.
You have been listening to a very different Word Temple tonight on KRCB, James Hilton's Lost Horizon, followed by Dylan Thomas's A Child's Christmas in Wales, and then a little jazz and a little Arisa White. So I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.